often hear about how the move from hunter-gatherer lifestyles to farming changed human existence in radical and indelible ways. We call it the agricultural revolution for a reason. Once we started cultivating our food, the reasoning goes, we learned how to organize complicated projects. We gained a sense of territorial ownership over land. We claimed and protected wealth. Except, wouldn't some of those changes have been necessary to spark an agricultural revolution? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Archaeologists are finding evidence that groups of people may have stayed together in one place, investing their energy in learning to live in permanent communities long before the rise of full-scale settled agriculture. One fascinating example comes from present-day Israel, where a remarkably ahead-of-its-time village seems to have thrived 2,000 years in advance of the spread of farming. Mati Friedman is a journalist and author who wrote about this recently for Smithsonian Magazine. His article is called, When Did Humans Start Settling Down? Mati, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here.
This is so interesting. There are, a lot of remarkable archaeological sites in Israel, but for a long time, the really ancient evidence of human activity didn't get as much attention or funding as biblical archaeology. Has that started to change?
That's right. I mean, the main event here, if you're an archaeologist, has always been the Bible. So evidence of, you know, the kingdom of David or findings from the time of Jesus. That's the kind of find that's likely to get headlines and funding. And the reason that the Holy Land is famous worldwide is because of the Bible and not because of prehistory. So the focus of archaeology here does remain those periods that are so resonant for so many people. But there's an increasing interest in prehistory because beyond being the Holy Land, which is a relatively recent description of this place, Israel was always an important geographic intersection for the movement of humans, particularly humans coming out of Africa and moving into Europe and Asia. So the human presence here is very, very old and very, very interesting, and more people are becoming aware of it.
So tell us about this site near the Sea of Galilee in what today is northern Israel. What evidence suggests that people may have gathered there in permanent settlements like millennia before what we call the agricultural revolution?
It's a beautiful site known as En Gib, and it sits on this slope leading down to the Sea of Galilee, which, if you haven't been there, is a kind of a blue oval surrounded by hills. And of course, it's also famous because it appears numerous times in the Bible, both in the Old and New Testaments. This site is in between the shore of the Sea of Galilee and the Golan Plateau. So on these hills that kind of roll gently down from the Golan Heights to the waterline, and it sits above a stream on a flat area, kind of a flat hilltop. And there's evidence, which archaeologists have known about since the early 60s, that there was a prehistoric settlement there. And Israel is full of prehistoric settlements, so that in itself doesn't make it dramatic. But a dig that's been going on there for the past 13 years indicates that this is one of the first examples of organized permanent settlement, and that it actually predates what we like to think of as the Big Bang that moves humans from being hunter-gatherers to being, you know, town dwellers or urban dwellers, which is the agricultural revolution that happened about 2,000 years after this village existed. And that makes it very, very interesting. So a team headed by a Hebrew University archaeologist named Lior Grossman has been working there. And every summer they come up with more amazing finds that scramble our understanding of exactly how humans settled down and kind of play with that traditional chronology that we have in our heads, which is that for many, many hundreds of thousands of years, humans are nomadic. And then they figure out how to domesticate crops. And that is the agricultural revolution that leads people to create these complex urban settlements. And eventually those settlements lead to our industrial societies of today with very organized bureaucracies and organized religion and methods of writing and Amazon.com and the IRS. And in the story, it's all kind of one progression that begins with the agricultural revolution. But the village at En Gib suggests that the move from nomadic life to settled life was more complicated than we thought.
How was this site discovered? How did people realize there was something there worth digging for?
So it was 1963, and the people responsible for discovering this site are two Israelis, young at the time. Both of them have passed away. One of them I managed to interview when I was researching the piece for Smithsonian, and he died just a few months after I interviewed him. A fascinating character named Dodi Ben Ami. And he, at the time, was a fisherman working in the Sea of Galilee, living at a kibbutz on the shore not far from where this site is located. And he's an autodidact. He never finished high school. He has no formal training as an archaeologist, but he had a really good eye for identifying ancient sites, particularly prehistoric sites. And he was walking around the hills outside the kibbutz past the banana orchards, which you can still see on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And he was with a friend who at the time was a young scholar of prehistory and eventually would become a professor of prehistoric archaeology at Harvard, whose name was Ofer Bar-Yosef. And they were hiking up on those hills between the waterline and the Golan Heights, which at this time, 1963, was very close to the border between Israel and Syria. And there had been a military position on this hill, and soldiers had dug a foxhole. Soldiers had been laying ambushes at the site to try to prevent infiltrations into Israel from Syria. The state of war existed at the time, right, more or less right where the site is, and they dug a foxhole. So they were looking at the foxhole and they realized that the soldiers had inadvertently dug an archaeological cross section. They dug into the soil, and this foxhole was full of prehistoric stone tools. So the foxhole was actually quite small. I mean, it's barely, you can see it today, it's barely deep enough to conceal a crouching soldier, but it turned out to lead back 12,000 years.
And what might that village have looked like 12,000 years ago?
It took many decades before any organized excavation began, and we're really only seeing it in recent years emerge as an important archaeological site, again, in part because attention here has always been focused mainly on biblical archaeology, and it's harder to get resources for prehistory. But now we're getting a portrait of this site, and the portrait is fascinating. We're talking about a village that probably had about 200 residents. A lot of this is guesswork, of course. There's no sign at the entrance to the village saying you are now entering the village of Ein Gev, population 203 or something like that. So there's a lot of guesswork being done by the archaeologists, but it's a city of several hundred people, maybe about 200. And there were stone houses, round houses of uniform design with a little kind of niche pointing out from one side of the house, which seems to have been an entranceway. So these are permanent houses, not, it wasn't a briefly inhabited nomadic settlement. This was a place where people were investing in construction, which means that they were staying. And there are many interesting artifacts just lying around the site. There's jewelry, there are beads, there's art, some very interesting figurines, human figures, kind of fascinating and evocative human face, a kind of very schematic, kind of T-shaped face with eyebrows and a nose, and there's a photograph of it in the Smithsonian article. It's quite a striking artifact. And there's evidence of crafts, and there's evidence that people were grinding grains, and there's evidence that people were harvesting crops, and people were making plaster right outside the houses of the village. And this is very interesting, although we take it for granted today. There was a cemetery, and this is one of the first cemeteries that we know of in human history. The idea that you have an organized place where you bury the dead together was not always the way humans did things. Sometimes, you know, of course, they wouldn't bother to bury anyone, and often people were buried in prehistoric times in the dwelling. So the idea that you have a separate place where you bury the dead is, you know, it seems predictable to us, but was quite revolutionary at the time. And we have a cemetery there too. So it's a small place, you know, just small village that is actually quite dramatic in terms of what it means for the course of human history.
So the people who inhabited this community today are known as Natufians. We can't know what they called themselves because they've been gone for a long time. Where does that name come from?
So the Natufians are a people who existed in this part of the world. I'm speaking from Jerusalem. So we're talking about the Levant, which is modern day Syria and Jordan and Israel and Lebanon and the Palestinian territories. And the archaeologist who discovers them is a fascinating character named Dorothy Garrod, who was the first woman to hold an archaeology professorship at Cambridge. And she's digging around here in the 20s and she discovers evidence of people who chronologically should have been hunter-gatherers, but clearly did not know that that's what they should have been because they were behaving like settled humans. And they were practicing something that looked a lot like agriculture, and they seemed to be living at their settlements year round or almost for the whole year. So they weren't wandering around. And she calls them Natufians just because that's the name of this riverbed, this wadi where she's digging, Wadi El Natuf. So these people become known as the Natufians. As you mentioned, we have no idea what they called themselves because writing would not be invented for another 7,000 years or so. So they spoke a language that we can't imagine and probably called themselves something completely different. But she picks up the Natufians and understands that these people are a crucial link in human history between the hunter-gatherers, which is the way humans had lived for most of the span of the existence of our species, to settled humans who are us, you know. And this is a relatively recent development in human history. It happens 10,000, 12,000 years ago. So she understands that these people are very important. There might have been a few thousand of them at a given time scattered around the Levant. They have certain distinctive forms of jewelry, sometimes made of polished gazelle bones, beautiful necklaces that you can see in museums around the world, including here in Jerusalem. They used shells from sea creatures in both the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. So these are people with a very heightened artistic sensibility and with clear technical abilities. And they seem to be that link between the hunter-gatherers and settled humans. And confusingly, all of this is happening before the event that we know as the agricultural revolution. So if you really dive into the Natufians, they require us to rejig the rather simplistic chronology that is known to many of us, certainly to the public at large.
Well, since the chronology is so essential in this story, that is one thing that makes these people so remarkable. How are archaeologists so confident that these folks lived around 12,000 years ago rather than fewer than 10,000 years ago?
So the village at Engev dates to about 12,000 years ago, and this is the end of the Natufian period. This is the very beginning. It's the borderline between the Paleolithic period and the Neolithic period. So this is the very end of the Natufian period, and the village will vanish for reasons that we don't know. And around the same time, the Natufians vanish. So they've been around for several thousand years before the village at Ein Gev is thriving. And it seems in some ways to be the height of their accomplishments. They were developing methods of living and forms of art and forms of, I don't want to use the word agriculture because it's a loaded term, but maybe horticulture. And it all kind of peaks in this village at Ein Gev, which seems remarkably modern. It seems like a village that should have existed several thousand years later and not at the time that it did. And the answer to your question is carbon dating. Carbon dating places the village at about 12,000 years ago, which means that it conforms to the Natufian period. And there are certain markers of Natufian presence, particularly a specific form of flint tool. And it's a kind of a tiny piece of flint that's shaped like a half moon. And it seems to have been used as an arrowhead or perhaps embedded in a wooden handle to be used as a kind of knife or axe. And that particular form of flint tool is associated with the Natufians, and the village at Ein Gev is packed with this tool. So archaeologists say with great confidence that this village was Natufian, meaning that it existed far earlier than it should exist based on our previous understanding of human development.
So, Mati, you mentioned that you didn't want to use the word agriculture. A lot of scholars studying the Natufians are careful to avoid that word. What is the difference between what some people have called intentional cultivation of plants and actual agriculture?
So, I mean, I guess I should preface it by saying that I'm a journalist, right? I'm not an archaeologist or an expert in the field. And, you know, as journalists, as you know, Chris, our expertise is basically to speak with great confidence about topics where our understanding might be shakier than we like to let on. Having said that, I did spend many, many months with the Natufians and speaking to prehistorians and And it was absolutely fascinating. And one of the focuses of these inquiries was this event called the Agricultural Revolution. And we take agriculture for granted, but it's actually quite recent in terms of the course of human history. And when we say agriculture, when we speak about the Agricultural Revolution, what we usually mean is the understanding by humans that you can use mutations in plants to your advantage. For example, if you're harvesting wild wheat, that's not going to be particularly efficient. However, if you can identify the 1 or 2% of the stalks of wheat that behave in a way that makes your life easier, for example, if the seeds don't disconnect from the stalk and rather stay on the stalk so that they can be harvested, that makes the life of a farmer much easier. So you can actually take that mutation and breed plants that you want. It's an act of harnessing nature. It's an understanding that we don't have to work for nature. Nature can work for us. So it's actually a radical reimagining of the place of humans in the world. And the chronology that we know generally places this event at about 10,000 years ago. And it's usually said to have happened in the area of northern Syria or eastern Turkey. And there's a lot of evidence for that. And one scholar who I spoke to and who I quote in the piece, Avi Gofer of Tel Aviv University, says that he can place it at about 10,500 years ago in that part of the world. And there are genetic explanations for why this happened and how it happened. And there's a pretty solid argument for the case that it happened quickly, that it was a kind of scientific breakthrough. It was kind of like the invention of gunpowder or electricity. Some very smart people had this kind of flash of understanding that you can harness mutations. You can take the plants that you want and breed them rather than running around and just kind of collecting what you can from the forest and the field. And that is generally what we mean when we say agriculture. And again, this happens about 10,000 years ago. The village at Ein Gev existed 12,000 years ago, so about 2 millennia before what we think of as the agricultural revolution. And here we have a big part of the debate about this site, which is, what does it say? What can we learn from it? And to what extent does it require us to rejig the chronology of human development as we've set it up for many years? And what the archaeologist at Ein Gev, at Lior Grossman, who's the head of the site and who's been running the dig there, is a fascinating character, by the way, and I really enjoyed spending time with her. What she says is that she's not necessarily arguing with the idea that humans figured out how to domesticate crops 2,000 years later in the area of northern Syria or eastern Turkey, but she thinks that that's kind of a secondary development, that the dramatic development is actually the decision to settle down in a community that is larger than one family and to develop a kind of complex society where different people are living alongside each other and specializing in different crafts and different forms of work. So you have some people hunting and some people fishing and some people making tools and some people making art. And that, she says, led to the agricultural revolution and not the other way around. So Ein Gev doesn't necessarily undermine the idea that crops were domesticated 2,000 years later, but she is arguing about the chicken and the egg. She's making a different case for what's important and what led to what.
Yeah, there may have been this sort of under-recognized revolution, which is the development of the capacity for organization. I mean, it seems obvious to us that if you're going to have a collective project like a farm that's going to require lots of people and you're going to need other people to do jobs like baking the bread and, you know, hunting the meat, whatever, you need some way of getting people to all contribute. But that didn't necessarily exist at that scale among hunter-gatherers.
Right. And that Lior Grossman would say is the revolution. Hmm. The revolution is not the scientific breakthrough that leads to the domestication of crops, but the understanding that a desirable form of life is to settle down in one place, stay there year round, and live with a community that is larger than a family. So hunter-gatherer groups were, you know, a dozen people, two dozen people. Now we're talking about several hundred people who are living together, and it's clearly a complex society. For example, one of the theories that I encountered when I was researching this piece was about jewelry. Why does jewelry begin to appear in earnest with the Natufians in this part of the world? It appears with a frequency that we don't know from earlier humans. We find necklaces and we find headdresses, some of which are incredibly elaborate and very beautiful. And one thing that seems to be going on there is that jewelry and decoration are connected to the emergence of a complex society. If you're living with your brothers and sisters and your parents and maybe an uncle or two, you don't need to differentiate yourself in the way you dress because everyone knows exactly who you are. It's when you start living in a larger group of people that people begin to want to distinguish themselves or show their status or show their belonging to a different subgroup with the way they dress or the way they decorate themselves. So according to that theory, the existence of a lot of jewelry at the Natufian sites is part of that emergence of complex societies. And we do it too, right? When we go out into the street and in Jerusalem or Dallas or whatever, we wear clothes that help us identify ourselves in the city. You might choose to wear, a hat, the hat of a sports team that you like, or a t-shirt associated with the university that you attended, or a kind of, sweater that, indicates the kind of person that you are. And that's very much a feature of complex societies, which that had never occurred to me before I read this piece about the Natufians, and then it kind of clicked. So that seems to have been going on with the Natufians. And again, this is before the agricultural revolution. So these people are practicing some kind of, they're harvesting crops. They're storing crops, which is quite advanced. And it's really the first evidence we have for food storage, which indicates some kind of advanced planning. So you're not just eating whatever you're harvesting the day you harvest it, you're actually planning for later in the year or the following year. And all of this contributes to the portrait of a society that's much more complex than was supposed to have existed at that time.
You know, Monty, the thing I've been thinking about ever since I read your piece that keeps coming back to me is this question. Was there some really brilliant thinker, some Da Vinci or Einstein or Aristotle or Curie or someone kind of lost to history who sparked the flourishing of this community with a few revolutionary ideas? Or was this just the product of having people settling together, learning from one another over time and passing down knowledge and good ideas?
Your guess is as good as mine. And I think in this case, my guess is probably as good as the guess of the archaeologists. We don't know. And we just know how humans are now. And we do know that there are people who are particularly brilliant. And sometimes there's a leader who is charismatic and who can, cause people to follow him or her. And I think it's important with the Natufians to say her, because there appears to have been a special place for women in the society. And we have examples of Natufian burials, one in particular of a woman who Lior Grossman, who excavated her grave, calls the shaman. And she was clearly some woman of great status. And she was buried with a lot of jewelry, and she was buried with the bodies of animals, including turtles and a leopard and an eagle. And there's clearly some important place for some women in Natufian society. So if there was a charismatic leader who decided that everyone was now going to settle in one place, it might well have been a woman. But I think that we scholars swing from histories that put exceptional individuals at the center to histories that put more broad processes at the center. So you can tell a story about the French Revolution that is very much about Louis XIV and Robespierre and the great leaders of the revolution. And that is very dramatic and I think true in many ways. Or you can zoom out and talk about the French Revolution as being the result of growing literacy and royal repression and other ideas that were kicking around Europe at the time. So we don't know, but there was probably, as in all human events, there was probably a bit of both.
So we have evidence now that even Neanderthals buried their dead as far back as 41,000 years ago. What stands out about the way the people at Engev established and maintained their cemeteries?
The most unique feature of the Engev cemetery is the use of a very high quality limestone plaster. So the bodies at the cemetery, and there are a few dozen of them, are encased in white plaster. And we have no idea why. But we do know that it would have been extremely difficult to manufacture that amount of high-quality plaster. So it meant that they were spending days or weeks bringing limestone and burning it and creating this plaster for a reason that makes absolutely no sense to us. Why were they pouring tons of plaster into their cemetery? But it certainly would have made the cemetery a very unique and striking feature in the landscape because it was white. It was as white as plaster. And we're talking about a kind of a radical change in human understanding of place. So until then, more or less, people hadn't had a home. And now they had a home. This was their place. And they were investing in it. They were building houses that were permanent. They were burying their dead there and encasing it in this very valuable material, which was limestone and plaster. And they're clearly associating themselves with one place because you don't go to that amount of trouble if you're just going to move on in a few months. So we have all these indications from this village that something new is going on. And the cemetery is one of those indications. It is, as I said, one of the first cemeteries that we know where many people are buried in one place over time. In this case, about 2 centuries of the lifespan of this village. The cemetery is right next to the houses, but it's not in the village. So previous burials might have been in the dwellings themselves, and we have many examples of that from earlier periods. But these people were at a cemetery, which we would have recognized, as a cemetery in the 21st century. And it's another indication that they're moving from nomadism to permanent settlement, and they're developing sentiments that are associated with home. Like we, of course, know what it means to miss your home or to have a hometown that has emotional resonance for you. If you go back to your hometown or if your folks are from a certain place and you go back there and you know that's where you're from, well, nomadic humans didn't have that necessarily. And here we see the beginnings of the evolution of that.
Yeah, this idea, Mati, of an emotional tie to the land they inhabited, this is so familiar today that we don't think about it. We just think of it as being natural, but it was like a stunning change from cultures that had always lived as nomads. How do we know that the Natufians' kind of territorial consciousness marked a division between the land that felt like theirs and the land beyond it?
Wow, there are great answers to that question. And again, it took me a while to even ask that question because we take it for granted. Of course, some places are yours and other places aren't. And you live in this area and some other group lives in a different area. And you have your property and there's a fence around it and that's yours. And the plot next door belongs to your neighbor. And humans just didn't think that way for many, many hundreds of thousands of years. And at Engev, we see that they're beginning to think that way. And one of the most interesting studies that indicates this change in thinking is, believe it or not, related to the teeth of gazelles, which you wouldn't think would, contain a lot of important information for human scholars. But the residents of Engev love to eat gazelles. They also like to eat hares and they like to fish for carp. But one of their favorite foods was the gazelle, which was very numerous around the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And a scholar named Gideon Hartman, who's at the University of Connecticut, thought that if he could check the isotopes in gazelle teeth from the site, he'd be able to figure out if these gazelle grazed around the village or much higher up on the Golan Plateau, because the hills around the village are mostly limestone. And the plateau, which is about 600 yards uphill from the village, is mostly basalt. So he thought he could identify isotopes that would tell him where these gazelles were grazing before they were hunted and butchered by the humans at Ein Gev. And indeed, he discovered that the gazelles that were eaten by the villagers all came from the vicinity of the village. And they, at least judging by the gazelle teeth, seem never to have gone up to the plateau, even though it was only 600 yards from the village. In addition, the artwork from the village, the stone figurines that I mentioned before, it's all from the immediate vicinity of the village. So we have very little indication that these people ever strayed from the immediate vicinity of the village. And that indicates that they had what anthropologists call territorial awareness. They had an idea of this being their place, which might suggest that other places belong to other people. and they knew not to go there. But it's a very different mode of thinking than the mode of thinking of nomadic hunter-gatherers.
Is there any evidence that they raised captive animals?
Wow, that's a great question. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I certainly didn't encounter any mention of domesticated animals. And I believe the answer is no, that animals are domesticated much later. And it's quite possible that they had no need to domesticate animals for food because animals were so plentiful. I mean, they lived a short walk from the Sea of Galilee, which is full of fish, and they had gazelles walking around. You could basically, you know, walk out of the village with your bow and arrow and bag a couple of them. So it's not like they were raising herds of cattle or anything like that. But there does seem to have been, at least in the Orgosman's theory, some agricultural terraces around the village, which might have been used for horticulture, I guess I should say, wait, I'm just gonna go back. There are agricultural terraces around the village, which seem to have been used for horticulture, not for agriculture, I should say. There were no animal pens. It didn't look like, you know, like a farm as we would imagine it today.
Mati, is there anything to suggest the Natufians, the people at Engev, may have had to defend their territory from wandering groups, nomadic groups who still existed and might have wished to occupy the same space, at least temporarily?
That's another great question. As far as I know, there's no evidence of conflict. They had axes, or they had bows and arrows, but as far as we know, those were used for pacific purposes, or at least as far as humans were concerned, I guess. The gazelles probably didn't see it as so peaceful, but no, we have no evidence, to the best of my knowledge, of any human-on-human conflict. And there must have been many nomadic groups moving around when these people were settled at Engev, but there were so few humans around this part of the world at the time that it's quite possible that there was enough room and enough animals and enough plants for everyone. The massive conflicts between people really begin later. And it's in large part because of that idea of territorial consciousness. If you don't have the idea that a place belongs to you or that you're a member of an organized group that's bigger than your family, then it's pretty hard to have an all-out war. So one of the many dubious benefits of the agricultural revolution and the move to settlement and this idea of territorial consciousness is conflict over land and resources. And I hope that the people of Engev didn't have to deal with that. They had many other challenges. You know, we know that they had to wake up every morning and go hunt for food. And I saw the skeleton of a three-year-old child in their cemetery. So clearly they had to deal with, you know, death of children, and they had to deal with disease, and there were no doubt wild animals around, and they had a lot on their plates. So I hope that they didn't have to worry about fending off the neighboring tribe.
When I hear that there were multiple stone houses in this little village of as many as 200 people, my automatic 21st century assumption is that those houses belong to nuclear family, right? Mother, father, children. There's no reason to assume that, of course. Do we know anything about their family structures or how they sort of organize themselves within the village?
We know very little about these people because there's no writing, of course, and all we have of them are these physical remains. We know the tools that they used. We have some instances of artwork, and the artwork is very striking, but also quite cryptic. It's hard to know exactly how to understand their art, and we have no other record, really. So the archaeologists know very little about these people, and they don't know if they lived in nuclear families, or they don't know the relations between the different groups that must have lived in the village. Was this a kind of tribe? Were the people cousins and second cousins, or was it some other form of organization? We know very little about them. And one of the heroic aspects of prehistoric archaeology is that. I mean, the archaeologist who's in charge of the site, she's kind of a genius at interpreting details that for most of us, we wouldn't even notice that they're there. It just looks like little stones on the ground. And she can pick up a stone and say, this is a tool, this is a flint tool. And you can see that it's been chipped in a specific way. It's been chipped to create a sharp edge. And from that, we can learn something about how they made tools. And if we use a microscope to look at the tool, and if we see a sheen on the sharp edge of the tool, then we know that that tool was used to harvest plants. That's quite amazing, but it doesn't tell us much about what they believed, what their religion was, if they had one, and how they organized their family and their village. So we know a lot, but it's still a tiny piece of a very complicated puzzle.
We have kind of mixed feelings today, right, about the rise of agriculture and its role in creating what we consider civilizations. First of all, like, what good did that development in human culture do?
And that's become a very heavy question. And I think a few decades ago, everyone would have agreed that the agricultural revolution was great. And we felt kind of bullish about civilization. And the idea of an agricultural revolution really takes off in the first decades of the 20th century, in large part because of a scholar named V. Gordon Childe, who was working at the same time as the communist revolution, and of course was very much aware of the industrial revolution. So we had this idea that humanity was progressing through revolutions, that we were masters of our own fate, and that we were climbing the ladder toward a better existence. And there were ups and downs. It wasn't completely smooth, but the revolution narrative suggests that things are moving in the right direction, and we are the movers. And I think that in the past maybe 10 years, maybe a bit more, we've become less sure that civilization was such a great accomplishment. And the West, if we can use that term, has lost a lot of its confidence. And people are looking around and seeing environmental havoc and social inequality and kind of a broken promise of a better world that we were building. And many people have started to wonder if that move to settled life was actually a good idea. And there are scholars making the case that it wasn't. The most famous today is probably Yuval Noah Harari, who's an Israeli scholar, most famous for his book Sapiens. And he describes the agricultural revolution as a trap. And in his depiction of the events, the nomadic lifestyle, which we used to see as, brutish and barbaric, was actually egalitarian, and it allowed people to do very little work and have enough to eat and move freely through the landscape, and no one had to work for anyone else, and no one had a king, and there wasn't someone, some overseer with a whip standing over you and making you harvest the wheat. You could just, pick some nuts and, go fishing and then have a long nap. And then the agricultural revolution comes along, and suddenly we're living in cities and we're developing these organized societies, in part in order to handle harvest surpluses. So you have, agriculture, and you have more wheat than you need, so you have to store it. And once you start storing it, you need to record how much you're storing. And then that system of recording becomes writing. And then you have tax records, and you have these complicated societies, which will eventually result in the IRS and, the surveillance state. And that there's a real case to be made that maybe that wasn't as great as we always thought. And there's a lot of current writing about it. It's actually a very, I mean, it seems very esoteric and old because it happened, 10,000, 12,000 years ago, but it's actually a very current debate, and it's quite fiery. And of course, like most debates about the past, it's actually a debate about the present and the direction of our society now. And are we the masters of nature as we would like to think? And certainly that's what the agricultural revolution narrative would seem to suggest. Or are we kind of a malfunctioning part of nature, and we can look at the climate and look at, how we're kind of exacerbating a problem that's no longer in our control. And it kind of makes you wonder whether domesticating crops and, taking control of nature was actually a good idea, or maybe we should have just stayed in the forest hunting and gathering. It's a very interesting debate. I mean, I think it's been decided, but I guess we can argue about whether it was good or not, but here we are, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I think that the mind-blowing question that comes out of this, Mati, is could there have been another way? Like, we assume in a strange way that the development of agriculture, because it happened almost simultaneously in so many parts of the world, it feels inevitable to us, but choices were still made about how to handle that.
There's an interesting book that came out recently called The Dawn of Everything, which makes exactly that case that we could have made other choices. And in fact, the authors argue that we did, that there wasn't a straight progression from being hunter-gatherers to discovering agriculture and then living in organized civilizations and, you know, now living in, living with the internet and being tracked by Google. They show in the book that humans move in and out of civilization. And I'm putting that in quotes. So sometimes people would develop into a more settled society and then revert. And there were people moving in and out of the settled areas. And they're trying to make a case that it's not inevitable. If you read Yuval Noah Harari's book, Sapiens, you get the impression that this is an inevitable progression from innocence to slavery. And what the Dawn of Everything argues is that it wasn't a clear progression, that there were ups and downs and backs and forths, meaning that today we can also make different choices. So, you know, we don't have to accept the societies that we live in as the only option possible, but we can imagine societies that are different, that are more equitable, that allow us more freedom. And that ties into current day politics as well. And one of the authors of The Dawn of Everything is actually one of the people who coined the term, we are the 99%, and was part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. So it ties very much into modern day politics and an attempt to imagine a different society today. And again, when humans argue about the past, they're almost always arguing about the present. And that's true in this case as well.
It's also true that when people are together and someone has a good idea, that idea is going to spread. And we may not in the beginning have a lot of information about what the long-term consequences will be.
That's right. And we're seeing it now. I think, you know, we're kind of at warp speed in terms of the decisions that we're making, but not really making. And a good example from the last few months is AI. That kind of happened. I don't remember voting for it or thinking that it was a good idea, but here we are. And of course, there are many examples of that from recent decades. I mean, the internet kind of happened and we thought it was great. And whether it's great or not, here it is. And for prehistoric humans, the pace of change was much slower, but it was also quite dramatic. And if we look at these people at Engev, we see that they're making a pretty incredible decision. And of course, they don't know what it means. You know, they just thought, okay, this is a better way to live. We're going to stay in one place and live in a larger group, and it's going to make our lives better, and it will feel less lonely. And they didn't realize where it was heading. And it kind of makes you wonder what decisions we're making now that people will think about in 10,000 years and wonder, you know, whether we did the right thing or not.
Looking at the present day site, it's sort of understandable why this group of humans decided to settle there, right? It's a beautiful place. And it's, to me, it feels like an interesting connection. Like people 12,000 years ago might have found the same things beautiful that we do looking across the landscape.
That is such a lovely thought. And I totally agree. And I encourage listeners to check out the article on the Smithsonian website to see the photos. You can read the text or not, but the photos are lovely, and you can really get an idea of the beauty of this place, which is this tiny kind of village clinging to a slope overlooking this kind of smooth blue oval, which is the Sea of Galilee. And it was just a beautiful place. And I agree. I think that was part of why they wanted to live there. They had an amazing view. They had great air. They could look in one direction and see these very dramatic hills leading up to the Golan Plateau. And they could look to the west and see this beautiful sea. And about 5 miles from their village is the other shore of the Sea of Galilee. And there are also beautiful hills rising on the other shore. And you can really imagine them waking up and looking out on this landscape and saying what you just said, which is, this is a beautiful place and I'm happy that we live here.
What are the most important unanswered questions from the perspective of archaeologists who are going each summer to excavate at this site?
The big one for the Or Grossman, who's the head of the dig, is the question of agriculture. To what extent was their horticulture agriculture, or to what extent were they actually growing crops in an organized fashion? And the Or privately will tell you that she thinks that there was organized agriculture. It might not have been the domestication of crops in terms of understanding mutations and how to grow certain mutations, but the suspicion is that there was organized agriculture happening at this village, because that would make the village make a lot more sense, that they were growing crops around the village, and there are these flat terraces near the village, and they have grinding stones that were used to grind grain, and we know that many of their tools were used to harvest plants, and that really is the question. And if Lior can prove that there was organized agriculture happening at the village and not just some kind of form of advanced horticulture, and that would be huge, and that might force us to really rethink whether or not the agricultural revolution happened 10,000 years ago, and or did it perhaps happen 12,000 years ago, and perhaps it happened at this village, which we know was a village of innovators. We know that they were coming up with things that would become ordinary later on, but we've never seen them before. And they were inventing tools that we only know from thousands of years later. When I was at the site, two graduate students were squatting in one of these round stone houses, and they were brushing earth away from this red material. And I walked up to them, and I kind of squatted alongside them, and I saw that what they were uncovering was pottery. It was clay, it was red clay. And I didn't think twice about it, because if you've ever gone to an agricultural dig, and I've been to many, of course you see pottery. And then I remembered that pottery was only invented in this part of the world 4,000 years later. And yet here it is at this village.
Matti Friedman is a journalist and author. His article, When Did Humans Start Settling Down?, was published in Smithsonian Magazine. Matti, thank you for making time to talk about this.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.